Welcome to today's edition of the Baseball America College Podcast. I'm Teddy Cahill, and joining me is Joe Healy. He is back. If you missed last week's preview episode, you didn't even know that Joe was gone, but Joe was out sick last Thursday. We welcome him back today, and we are here to talk about a very busy slate of college baseball in week four. Conference play began for the ACC and the Pac-12, and it delivered a lot of exciting action in both of those two conferences. Number one Texas is no longer number one. The preseason number one team lost a series at South Carolina. So we've got movement at the top of the Baseball America Top 25 for the first time this season. We'll get into how South Carolina bounced back and won its series against Texas. And we'll break down the new number one team in the country. That is Notre Dame. We got a lot to get to today on the Baseball America College Podcast. And we're glad that you're joining us today as we record this Monday, March 14. You might be thinking hoops, but Joe, I know what you're thinking. And that's Tom Brady not being retired anymore.
Yeah, man, talk about... He retires, and this wasn't his doing, you know, in the first part, but the day he retires is also the day when former Dolphins coach Brian Flores sues the NFL, which was, arguably swallowed up the news of Tom Brady's officially retiring. And then, on Selection Sunday, Tom Brady comes out. I saw somebody comes out and says he's going to return. I saw somebody tweet that, Tom Brady had one spring forward where he lost an hour of sleep with kids and decided that was enough of being home. Because I know that that spring forward can kind of be a rough day, especially when you have kids, or even in my case, like a dog, where it just kind of throws off your whole schedule. So because you're still keeping to a schedule. But regardless, I was surprised. I'm not surprised that Brady is back in the game. I think there were enough people out there saying that I can't be surprised about it. I am a little surprised though, that he didn't like get something out of it, like not having to show up for, camps in summer, or waited a little longer, or, took an entire year off. But that guy has talked way too much about wanting to play until he's like 48 or 50 for him to have stepped away as seemingly neatly as he did last year, where he's like, I'm just done. So I'm not surprised in general, but I am surprised by the timing of it.
Well, let's sprint forward from that. Yeah, you like that transition, Joe?
Hey-o.
Let's sprint forward into this weekend that was in college baseball. Tom Brady can't overshadow everything.
That's right. The eyes of the nation were glued to college baseball instead of Tom Brady.
Or the selection show last night. Everyone That's was right. watching the end of Texas and South Carolina, which happened, I think, exclusively during the selection show, which I watched none of as a result. So South Carolina hosting Texas last week and this weekend. And the Gamecocks were reeling coming into this series. They were swept last week by arch rival Clemson. They then went out on Tuesday and lost to Xavier. And that all seemed to take a lot of the shine off of this series, which was, on paper, it should have been a pretty intriguing series. Like, it should have been what we got. Two pretty good teams going at it. We think South Carolina is a regional team. But the way that they were playing coming into this series was not great, having lost four in a row. It was supposed to start on Friday. Bad weather in the Carolinas, just like there was bad weather pretty much everywhere east of the Rockies this weekend. So there's bad weather in the Carolinas. They pushed the start of the series to Saturday. Texas wins. South Carolina looked pretty good. They got to Pete Hansen in a way that nobody really had gotten to Pete Hansen yet, but it wasn't enough. Texas wins. They then are concluding the series with a doubleheader on Sunday, and South Carolina behind Will Sanders, went out and won 4-2 in a scheduled seven inning game for the first game. And that sets up a big rubber game to finish this thing off. Texas to this point had not lost a series all season. And, they now they're playing a rubber game for the first time, in fact. And they're doing it without Tanner Witt, who of course was ruled out for the season on Thursday. as he'll undergo Tommy John surgery. So this was a big moment, and for both teams really, because South Carolina is also looking at this as a chance to really get a marquee series win and get some momentum going into SEC play. And that's exactly what they did. Their offense kept going. They win on Sunday. They really kind of won going away. Texas put some runs on late in the ninth inning that makes the final score look a little better, but it wasn't really much of a comeback attempt, as it was just like a few runs in the ninth inning. And Texas loses a series for the first time this year and falls out of the number one spot in the top 25. But to me, Joe, I mean, the bigger thing here is that South Carolina got off the mat after losing five straight games and won this, swept this doubleheader. It's kind of a wonky thing that it was just that they swept a doubleheader. We know that, you know, bad days happen in this sport, but you know, credit to South Carolina for coming out and having its best day of the season against maybe, you know, the best team that it'll play. It's certainly the best team it's played to this point and one of the best teams it'll play all year.
Yeah, I think you're right that it is the story, and those getaway day doubleheaders can be, even though, you know, Texas is staying out in the Carolinas, it's not a traditional getaway day, but those Sunday doubleheaders can really get wonky on teams, especially when you're dealing with a shortened game. And the first game in that doubleheader was seven innings. It seems like every year there's a team or two that kind of gets got on that type of doubleheader. And this time around, it just happened to be Texas. And I think it's a great point you make about South Carolina's regional hopes. I mean, sure, they were reeling. I totally agree with that assessment. But this series was big, not just to get them back heading in that right direction, but you and I talked before the season about, you know, some of the small differences that can be made for teams to be either a regional team or not a regional team. And we talked about South Carolina and the fact that their schedule is fairly favorable in terms of the SEC draw they got. There's a lot of winnable series on that schedule, even if you don't necessarily 100% believe in the Gamecocks. I think the key for them is just kind of flipping one or two series. And hey, this isn't a conference series, obviously, although it soon will be. But they just flipped one by winning that series against Texas. So that series win alone, I think, puts them back on track to being the postseason team that we think they can be if they kind of handle their business in the series that I think they should handle in the SEC moving forward, knowing, of course, we know that nothing is necessarily easy in the SEC, but it was huge. And for Texas, I think, I'll say it this way first. I think South Carolina was impressive offensively. The run totals don't necessarily, although, you know, nine runs in that finale, like they did have their moments, but they were pretty relentless against good pitching. It's not just that they won a couple ugly games, or they happened to win 2-1 when their guy just outdid Texas. I mean, they got to Pete Hansen. They got to Tristan Stevens. They did a good job.
Tristan Stevens hadn't given up a run all season until Saturday.
Yeah. I mean, they got to Texas's good guys. I mean, even the loss against Pete Hansen, like they got to him. And so it was a really nice performance, I felt like, offensively for South Carolina. And then on the flip side, you know, you and I have stopped short of really calling Texas's offense a liability to this point in the season, because the proof was in the pudding that they were doing enough. But this was a weekend where they got behind the eight ball in that doubleheader on Sunday, and their offense just wasn't quite able to get them out of it. They tried. There were a rally in both games, and it was way too late in the second game. But in the first game, they scored some runs late, got a couple guys on base in the last inning against Michael Braswell for South Carolina, and they just couldn't quite do enough. And so in this specific weekend, when they got behind, their offense was not quite able to make up the difference.
Yeah, South Carolina is an intriguing team on the mound right now. They are really beat up. Julian Bosnick hasn't pitched this year. They have another starter that is going to be out for the season as well. Will Sanders is a big time talent, and you saw why on Sunday. And, you know, he is a first round talent next year. But they're missing some pieces, but they went out this weekend and they pitched really well against, I still think Texas can be a solid offense, but you're right. I mean, this weekend, it wasn't there for them. And it was the weekend that the pitching staff really needed it to be there for them. And this time the Texas offense wasn't able to answer the bell there.
I do think you got to give credit to Will Sanders. You got to give credit to Matthew Becker, who was making his first start in the finale of that series. And he struck out 11 in six innings. So those two guys really, you know, carried the torch for South Carolina on Sunday, did the bulk of the heavy lifting on the mound. And then Michael Braswell, who's a freshman two-way phenom right now for the Gamecocks, came in and got the save in the first game. And he has three saves and five scoreless appearances. You know, I don't want to that was Becker's first start. Like, he's pitched well to this point out of the bullpen, but maybe those guys, that maybe that's the core of something moving forward. You know, we'll have to see how South Carolina works going forward, but they have an offense. This is a solid offensive team. And if they are able to find more depth on the mound, or just have more weekends like this where, you know, two, three guys can kind of carry the whole load, you know, it becomes a pretty dangerous team. I also think on the Gamecocks that this was massive. That cannot be overstated. Not only do you go and you beat the preseason number one team in the country, the team that you know, had played like the number one team in the country as well for the first 3 weeks, but if they had lost this series, you know, they really were going to be looking at they're going to be looking at fighting back out of a pretty significant hole. Like, they're swept by Clemson, they lose to Xavier. If they lose one more game, if they lose one of those games on Sunday, they're looking at, you know, being 1-6 over the last, you know, seven games, obviously going into SEC play. Yeah, they play Gardner Webb midweek, and, you know, you figure that they can win that game. But, you know, just to start SEC play next weekend, they're at Tennessee, and then Vanderbilt comes to Columbia. And if you're coming off of back-to-back series losses against Clemson and Texas, and then you're staring that in the face, that's a really tough way to start SEC play. And it still is. But now you go into SEC play and you go into Knoxville knowing that, hey, we just beat the number one team in the country. Like, we can play with anyone. And like that literally means we can play with anyone. We can beat anyone on any given day.
It's a great point. I mean, their SEC schedule is fairly front loaded when you talk about starting with Tennessee and then Vanderbilt. And then they get Missouri. It is on the road, but then they've got two more ranked teams in Georgia and Ole Miss right after that, before they get to a period of time when they've got Auburn and Alabama and Texas A&M and Kentucky, which you all figure are winnable series for the Gamecocks. But had they not won this series and then they go to Knoxville and then play Vanderbilt, there's a chance by the time you get to that point of the schedule, you've taken on too much water. So you're right that this was huge. You you mentioned Michael Braswell, who has just been electric offensively and then on the mound in shorter stints. But he reminds me a little bit when I watch him pitch. It reminds me a little bit of when you were a kid and you were playing on a tournament team, a travel team, and you just had a kid who was just the best player on the team, and he pitched because he had a really good arm and was a really good athlete. And Braswell kind of reminds me of that, where it's like, he's a good pitcher, don't get me wrong, I'm not trying to slight him. It's just that he looks like a position player pitching and just happens to be really good at it. Like, the athleticism like jumps off, but he's also pitching with like dirty baseball pants because he's been playing shortstop and hitting all game. And like, it's not the most polished guy on the mound, but like, you can just see the talent like oozing off of him. Every time I've seen him pitch a few times now, and it seems like every time I flip it on, actually, because I'm coming in late in the game, like, he seems like he's on the mound. But it strikes me so much of like playing as a kid, where you throw the best guy you've got on the mound and you hope that's enough. And so far for them, it has been in terms of him closing games. But he's a guy who I just have a lot of fun watching. Like, he's not alone in having changed a little bit the complexion of the South Carolina offense. I think steps forward for a guy like Braylon Wimmer has been big, but, you know, Brant Belk and Kevin Madden from the transfer portal have been huge as well to really change the face of this offense. But as a freshman, Braswell has gone a long way just in his own to making this a little bit of a different team.
Yeah. So he is leading the team in hitting right now, and he's operating as, you know, a closer that has yet to allow a run in five appearances. He's hitting .417, has a .527 on base. Like, he is maybe the most exciting thing happening at South Carolina right now. And like, that's saying something. Like, Will Sanders is really good. And Andrew Eister continues to like somehow come up in every single clutch situation and find a way to get big hits for South Carolina. Like, there's a lot to like about this team just from a pure viewing perspective, but Braswell is right at the top of the list for me. On Texas, Joe, this strikes me that this last week has been a really challenging week for Texas. It's kind of the first time they really got hit by adversity. Well, it is the first time they got hit by adversity all season, to the best of my knowledge. I'm not in the clubhouse every day, obviously, but from the outside, this sure seems like the first time adversity has come to Texas all season. It starts with them taking their first loss of the season last Sunday against UCLA at the Shriners College Classic and learning that day that Tanner Witt was getting scratched. Then they play Texas State on Tuesday and Wednesday and kind of just found themselves in a serious dogfight with Texas State, which is a good team. And, you know, it's a local, it's a team that's very close to Austin. It's not a local rival. Like, that's not the way to describe it, but Texas State is very motivated to go out and play well against Texas. And this year they have a team that was capable of doing it, and they wind up playing two really tight games against Texas State in the midweek and, you know, probably expended a whole lot more emotional energy than they ever would have wanted to or really expected to in midweek games, and split the midweek home and home and lose at Dish Falk. Then on Thursday, they find out that Tanner Witt, or at least it's publicly announced that Tanner Witt is going to have Tommy John surgery and is out for the year. And then they go to South Carolina, get hit with bad weather. The series gets condensed. They get swept in a doubleheader, and now they have, you know, a losing weekend for the first time, and they've lost four of their last six games. You know, this is a big moment for them, I think. Now they're staying in South Carolina this week. They're playing College of Charleston in the Citadel on Tuesday and Wednesday, and then they go home to play Incarnate Word. It's not a challenging week in terms of the opponents, but it is a test, because this is a team that, you know, can't afford to let this spiral. I don't think they will, but they can't afford to let it spiral. They have to get right this week before Big 12 play starts in a week's time against Texas Tech. And, you know, this is a team that went through even worse than this last year. They started last year 0-3. They got swept in the State Farm showdown last year. And, you know, to start the season 0-3, even knowing that you lost to three really good teams, like, psychologically, that's a lot. They were able to come back from that and win the Big 12 and go to Omaha and be one of the last four teams standing. They know how to do this, but they now have to do it this year. They absolutely got punched this week, probably multiple times. You can say they got punched. And now they have to show that they're going to keep standing and start punching back.
Yeah, that's right. I mean, it's a tricky week in a weird way, because they're staying out on the road. They kind of have to sit with it a little bit. Instead of, you know, getting back home and being able to reset. So they've got, you know, midweek games they should handle, and then Incarnate Word this weekend back at home, which they should handle as well. And it's, I think I'm going to be looking this week to see how much they bounce back. Or, I mean, are you just winning those games? Because, I mean, they could play pretty sloppy baseball and probably still go 5-0 this week. But are you just winning those games, or are you making a statement with those games? And I'll be looking for them to do the latter. And I think they should be. You know, obviously they're thankful that they have this kind of week ahead of Big 12 play, because they do start off with a trip to Lubbock. And while the jury is still out on what exactly Texas Tech is this weekend, they are playing better baseball. And there's no doubt about the fact that Lubbock is one of the toughest places to play in the country. So certainly they are, I'm sure, thankful the Longhorns are to have this little week in between.
Yeah, so we'll definitely watch that. We'll watch how Lucas Gordon progresses as a member of the rotation. There is a lot to watch right now with Texas. They fall to number four in the Baseball America Top 25. Still think highly of them. They still have a really sound resume. This doesn't have to be more than a bad week. But again, like, this is the first time they're being challenged by adversity. How they bounce back is the thing to watch here over the next week plus. All right, we're going to get into the start of ACC play, the start of Pac-12 play, and the new number one team in the Baseball America Top 25 here in a minute. But first, check this out.
We can find reasons to celebrate in the unusual, but also in the everyday. Celebrate a friend for their promotion, their wedding, their new baby. Or celebrate yourself for keeping the couch warm. Maybe celebrate the fact that you can watch 15 college baseball games in one night without leaving that couch. That's something that I may celebrate on a pretty regular occasion on a Friday night. Or maybe you just want to celebrate living in 2022, where you can get beer, wine, and spirits delivered from Drizzly in under 60 minutes without leaving said couch. Drizzly is the most convenient way to buy beer, wine, and spirits, with delivery to your doorstep in under 60 minutes. Right now, Drizzly is giving all new customers $5 off their first order with code FAST5. That's FAST5. So download the Drizzly app. It's the number one app for alcohol delivery. Or go to drizzly.com. That's drizly.com. And use promo code FAST5 for $5 off of your first order.
All right, Joe, we talked about the team that was number one coming into the weekend. Let's get to the team that is now number one. That is Notre Dame. Fighting Irish improved to 11-1 on the season with a abbreviated sweep of North Carolina State this weekend. They went to Raleigh. They only played two games. They played Friday. It was raining pretty hard by the end of that game. They win in extra innings, 8-4. Had to come back from a four-run deficit early. Ultimately win 8-4 and 12. They don't play Saturday. Most teams in that area didn't play on Saturday. They then only played a single game on Sunday, and Notre Dame won that. The final score looks really good for Notre Dame, but the reality was they were in control the whole way. They never trailed, but the game got tight in the middle innings, and then the NC State bullpen could not finish the deal, and Notre Dame really took advantage of some sloppy play by the Wolfpack late to walk away with a very comfortable win, 11-4. And Notre Dame now, well, they were number three. We gave a very serious debate between Notre Dame, Ole Miss, and Oregon State for who should be the number one team in the country. Those are the top three teams now in the top 25. We settled on Notre Dame. And they are rolling again this season. Have to be impressed by the way the Irish played, not only this weekend, but all season long.
Yeah, I think it was a weekend for Notre Dame where you really kind of saw the championship mentality, for lack of a better way of putting it, and to use a cliche, especially in that first game where, you know, NC State got up on them quick, and NC State's the type of team that can really snowball things on you. They're a little bit like Tennessee sometimes. We talked about Tennessee in this way earlier this season, where when things are going good, they're really going good. And Notre Dame didn't let that happen. They, you know, the bullpen was excellent on Friday. The offense chipped away, and then won it in extra innings. And, you know, kind of a similar deal to some degree on Sunday, where it was, to your point, a tight game close, and then it's Notre Dame that's going to pull away in this game. They didn't let NC State pull away in that game. So a really solid weekend for them. A weird deal with Saturday, like, you know, I don't want to dive too deep into it, but just game was canceled like an hour before it was supposed to start, and like the weather was bad, don't get me wrong, like I'm not debating that the weather was bad, but you know, Carolina and Pitt played like 15 minutes 30 minutes down the road, you know, so. And it wasn't pushed to Sunday, and I guess travels is, I'm sure, a part of that, but because it was going to be cold on Sunday, so it's not like you could really start at 9 a.m. probably. But anyway, just a weird deal there. And of course, Twitter being Twitter, there was, in the comments, there was finger pointing and assumptions being made, and all that kind of jazz. And in a lot of ways, it was reminiscent of last year in the ACC, frankly, where there was some of this stuff going on with cancellations and all that jazz. But you know, Notre Dame, I think, showed why we think as highly of them as we do, proved again the team they, if any, I mean, at this point, nobody should be doubting what they are and what they did last year, but this was the type of thing again that shows that, oh yeah, this is that same team. This is just a different program now, to go out and do what they did, even if NC State is a team that's still trying to figure it out a little bit. And yes, we did talk about Ole Miss and Oregon State. And I think really the debate ended up being between Oregon State and Notre Dame, because if you're basing it on resume, like Oregon State has some things there. They won a conference series on the road against Washington State. They've beaten Gonzaga a couple times this season. So on resume, they've got some things going for them. But we ultimately went with, hey, let's keep these teams in the order we had them in. It's too early in the season necessarily to mess with that too much. And that's how we end up with Notre Dame, a deserving number one. And a number one, it's funny how quickly we get used to the current conditions in college baseball. But the idea that you would tell me in 2022 that Notre Dame would be number one and we'd all just kind of like nod our head and be like, yep, okay. If you told me that in 2019, I would not have known what exactly to say, because it is kind of amazing how quickly this turnaround has completely changed the complexion of the program.
On NC State here, team we didn't really, you know, obviously we're focusing a lot on Notre Dame here, but NC State, the fall has been precipitous. Over the last 2 weeks, Joe, I watched a fair amount of the series. I'm sure you did as well. The thing that's really striking me right now is NC State is not fielding the ball. And, you know, we made a lot about how they turned over their lineup last year and how offensively, like, they sure looked like they were going to be fine. And early in the season, that bore itself out. And, like, they're still scoring a fair amount of runs, even in the skid. But what they're not doing is playing defense.
Yeah, I mean, it was never going to be a defense as good as last year's. I mean, Elliott Avin has been pretty open about the fact that it's the best defensive team he's had. And that's saying something, because that program fields the ball pretty well year to year. That's something you can really set your watch to. But you're right, it has been a stark difference. And I think some of that is that they've got so many bats that they've kind of had to, I think we may have talked about this a little bit at some point earlier this season, but it strikes me that they have enough bats they want to get in the lineup. They have had to move some guys around, and it's not that those guys necessarily can't play the positions they're in. They're not asking, like, they don't necessarily have, let me put it this way, they don't necessarily have a Jacob Berry problem at LSU where it's like, okay, we know his bat has to be in there, so we're going to try him in places that, like, we know he's not a great fit, but we just have to grin and bear it. But I think with State, they've got guys who are a little more equipped to do the job, but they may have some guys in positions that aren't necessarily the optimum places. I'm not enough of a defensive guru to like tell you where that is necessarily, but it is a bat over field lineup generally, especially right now. The thing is though, like this program does field the ball pretty well year to year. So I do have some confidence that by the time the end of the season rolls around, it's going to be a little bit better, but I think it's clear at this point, it's just going to be nowhere near as clean a defensive team as the one we saw last season.
Yeah. And I think that was kind of an underrated aspect of how good last year's team was, that, you know, you could get distracted by, you know, how good the offense was and you know, the way that they did the heater they got on at the end of last season. But the fact is that they fielded very consistently, and that was something they could always rely on. And they don't have that this year. Right now. And I definitely think that's a part of why they are where they are. And they're going to really have to correct that. They got to correct, it's not just one aspect of this, but that is something that they're going to have to fix moving forward. Joe, you mentioned how fast we adjust to new realities in college baseball and really just in general, in sports. Notre Dame has not been, do you know when the last time Notre Dame was number one in the Baseball America top 25?
You know, I read this in Off the Bat this morning, which is a great feature that Teddy puts out every late Sunday night, early Monday morning. So I know it's sometime in the 2001 season, but had I not seen that, I actually probably would have guessed that they had never been number one. I knew they would have been close, but I would have guessed that it hadn't happened, but I did see it was in 2001.
It's remarkable that it had been that long. And that also, yes, that like it had been that long, and you know what, like it feels right that Notre Dame's number one. Like that's just what they were able to do last year. They haven't been 11-1 to open a season since 2015. And they almost immediately went south after going 11-1 in 2015. They had a fine season that year, but they took a couple losses in a row. So assuming they win this Tuesday against Valpo in the home opener and they get to 12-1, I'll have to go back to the Notre Dame record book and find out the last time they were 12-1. And, it's an intriguing spot for Notre Dame to be. this is not something that we've seen in a long time in college baseball. Pulmoneri was the head coach the last time Notre Dame did this. You know, the number one song in the country was All For You by Janet Jackson. Like, I mean, these are, it has been quite some time, obviously, but very well done by Notre Dame to this point. They have yet to play a home game. I think that also cannot be overlooked as we, you know, debate resumes and just look at how good teams are or aren't right now. Notre Dame has not played a home game. Home opener is scheduled for Tuesday. They're on the road again this weekend at Louisville. This is just the reality of their early season, but they are playing very well here out of the gate, despite all of the challenges that they faced, and certainly looking like, you know, they're the reigning ACC champs, and they're certainly looking like that they're capable of going out and winning another ACC title this spring.
I love the benchmark of like what the number one song was in the country when things happen. Like I tend to roll my eyes sometimes at like the kind of trite things that writers will use to kind of mark time. But that is one that I think in a normal situation I would roll my eyes at. But maybe it's the way music can kind of like drive emotion and really take you back to a time and place. But like, I actually kind of like that one. I don't know why. I really do think it is just like, I start thinking about what, like my relationship to that song and like what I was doing at that time and that time in my life. And I like that one. And Janet Jackson's All For You, certainly a song that does take me to a time and place.
Are you ready for the number one movie in America?
Let's do that one. You know, I'm not as big a movie. I wouldn't profess to be a huge music guy either, but I'm music more than movies. Not a big
movie. Yeah, so guy, I went with music for a reason, because I literally don't even know anything about this movie. It's Driven.
The Sylvester Stallone racing.
Yeah, it's
vehicle,
a Sylvester
right?
Stallone yeah. racing movie. Yeah, it was number one for a week. That's all it got.
That is so funny that it's that movie, because I have seen that movie. I remember watching it for the first time, and it was that movie where I felt like no one was really talking about that movie. And I kind of liked racing as a kid, like less so now. I'm like the last guy in America who hasn't decided he really likes Formula One now.
I'm there with you, JJ. Yeah. Or JJ Cooper, our boss, don't listen to this as we disparage F1.
Yeah. Like, I'm sure it's like, I understand the appeal, but like, it's just not for me. But like, as a kid, like I was kind of intrigued by racing, and especially particularly open wheel racing. And so like, I actually liked the movie. And then it wasn't until several years later that I realized like, oh, most people weren't talking about that movie because it actually wasn't any good. But I didn't know any better, because let's see, in 2001, I was 13 years old. And you know, when you're 13, your bar is a little bit lower for what's quality. And it had cool, in my mind, cool racing scenes, and I liked some of the songs in the soundtrack, and that's really all it took. So it's funny that it's that movie, because I might be the most equipped person in the world not named Sylvester Stallone to have an opinion on that movie.
that is quite interesting. Again, it is one that I got nothing on that one. That's why we didn't lead with the number one movie. That's why we led with the number one song.
Yeah, that's right. Janet Jackson, everyone understands that.
Yeah, I got that. I got nothing on Driven. Alrighty, so that's Notre Dame, and that was the big ACC series of the weekend. It was a top 25 showdown in Raleigh, but there was a lot of interesting ACC action in the slate beyond that series. Florida State went to Wake Forest. They won the series. They did it by winning a doubleheader on Sunday after losing the opener on Friday. Virginia went to Duke, won the series. They fall from the ranks of the unbeaten, however, as Duke clipped them in the finale. UVA made a strong late comeback, but Duke was able to hold them off. You also had Georgia Tech sweeping Virginia Tech in a slugfest. Boston College beat Miami on Friday night, and then Miami came back and won the series. UNC swept they swept Pitt, and Clemson and Louisville were out of ACC action. Clemson notably won a series against Northeastern, but like Virginia, it falls from the ranks of the unbeaten as Northeastern clipped it on Sunday. That leaves Purdue as the last remaining undefeated team in the country at 14-0. And Louisville won a very strange series against Michigan. They tried to play a doubleheader on Friday, got caught in the snow in the second game, had to suspend that until Sunday. They split those first two games, and then Louisville came out and pretty handily won the finale to claim the series. That's ahead of a really big series against Notre Dame that I'm sure we'll talk about more on Thursday. But Joe, from that ACC slate, what struck you?
Yeah, a lot of different stuff. I mean, one, the business-like approach that North Carolina took in sweeping Pitt. And, you know, it's probably true that Pitt is not quite as good as they were last year when they were very nearly a postseason team. And in an alternate reality was a host last year. Remember that? So there is something to that. But, you know, that's a North Carolina team that didn't necessarily really do things like that last season, even against teams that should have done that against. So I was pretty impressed by that. Louisville is kind of doing like a little bit of a snake in the grass routine right now, where like, don't look now, but they're kind of working their way back. And if I haven't done a full accounting of what has all kind of gone on there, I'll admit that after I saw them in Tampa, I kind of filed them away and haven't necessarily circled back on them yet, but also got a midweek.
I mean, we can get into that because I did do a little bit of that in off the bat, but we also can save it. But the short version for Louisville is that they're 11-3, and up until this weekend since Tampa, they hadn't been tested. But this was a good weekend for them, and you know, they're hitting the ball really well. They need to find some more depth on the mound, but Riley Phillips Tate Kuhner. Tate Kuhner? Yeah. So those two guys,
Keener, as if Tate, like, two Keener. Are there. Yeah, okay. Tate Keener. Yeah.
They're building blocks in that rotation, I think. You know, and I'll be interested to see how the rotation sets up, you know, this weekend and the pitching staff in general, as Jared Poland has also pitched really well and didn't start this weekend. And you know, we'll just see how they go. But they're building some momentum here.
Yeah, so that's kind of interesting. You know, I will circle back on Louisville. Obviously, we'll talk about it probably leading up to the weekend. So that is definitely interesting. Quickly on Wake Forest, team is clearly better. Now, I say that, and like, if you go back to last weekend, or last season, I should say, they started their season off by being very competitive against Notre Dame. So, you know, we'll give it some time. But played Florida State really, really well. And then on Clemson, you know, that's the team, and we've talked about them quite a bit, but I think that's the team that maybe has improved its standing just kind of in my eyes from preseason to now in the ACC more than anyone. North Carolina certainly is also in that mix, but their resume is pretty strong at this point when you consider that Northeastern is better than its record shows, because I don't know if you've noticed, we've also talked a lot of Northeastern because they've been playing good teams, and they swept NC State, obviously. So that's a good team. They just won that series against them. You know, they began their season sweeping Indiana. Okay, we can take or leave that. Not sure how good Indiana is, but also they won that, they swept a series against South Carolina that now just beat Texas. And so, again, too early to really draw too many conclusions from that, but I do get the sneaking suspicion that Clemson is a team that's just better, you know, significantly better than we thought coming into the season. So I kind of continue to be impressed by them. So definitely some learning opening weekend of ACC, but as we kind of learned last year, you know, it is the ACC. So I expect some of these lessons that we think we've learned will be undone probably in short order.
I am also intrigued by Clemson. They get Miami at home this weekend in their ACC opener. And that series is one that, you know, it might be a little under the radar because Miami doesn't have a number next to its name, but that's one that I'm going to be very interested in how it plays out. Two other notes that stood out to me this weekend, Nate Savino threw a shutout, five-hit shutout on Friday. If you're looking for Virginia to be as good as we think they are coming into the season, and like our rankings reflect that and all the rest of that, if you're there with us or just wondering why we think that, it's because we think that Nate Savino can be that kind of pitcher, and he showed it on Friday at Duke. And you know, that would be a massive development for Virginia. It is a massive development that Savino has pitched as well as he has so far, but you know, that was a big start for him and for UVA to start ACC play. And then the other one is that Florida State wins that series in Wake Forest, and they did it losing on Friday. So they lost with Parker Messick the reigning ACC pitcher of the year, not having his best day. He didn't pitch badly necessarily. He just wasn't his day. Ross Dunn was outstanding. Like of the three Florida State starters, Ross Dunn is definitely the one that we have talked about the least and definitely has gotten the least love anywhere, maybe outside the Dunn household. But like when you have preseason All-Americans in Messick and Hubert pitching in front of him, like this is what happens. But Dunn was amazing in the finale. And if Florida State's going to have three legitimate like high-end starters in the rotation, that's a big development. Still need to see more from them in other areas of the game, but I thought they pitched really well against what we think. I keep saying that Florida or that Wake Forest has a powerful offense. I don't know that we know that yet, but we think that's a pretty good offense that Florida State, for the most part, shut down this weekend.
Yeah, I mean, it was an offense that, you know, Brock Wilkin kind of came on late in the weekend and did some things, but, they really did a nice job on him the first couple of days. And if you're looking for just like little windows into capabilities, you know, Florida State being able to do that against a guy who most people think is one of the better position players in the ACC and nationally, certainly that's a good sign.
Absolutely. Also, just quickly on Florida State, they play Florida on Tuesday. Obviously, that is one of the highlights of the non-conference season. So if you're looking for midweek action Tuesday, you got Florida State and Florida. All right, Joe, let's head out west. The Pac-12 is the other major conference that opened conference play this weekend, and it was a pretty wild weekend. There were five conference series. Four of them were won by the road team. That includes kind of expected results like Arizona going to Cal and winning, although the way they did it was not necessarily expected, and Oregon State going to Washington State and winning that series. It also included, though, Oregon going to Stanford and beating the Cardinal in the first two games. And it was a series that was played in just a very intriguing way. Friday night was a pitcher's duel that Oregon wins 4-3, back and forth late in that game. Stanford had pulled even at three in the bottom of the eighth inning. And then immediately in the ninth inning, Tanner Smith hits a leadoff home run to put Oregon back in front. And that proved to be the difference. It was a slugfest on Saturday that Oregon won 16-13, and then Stanford, salvaged the finale. So that was a crazy series. And then also USC goes to UCLA and wins the rivalry series for the first time in quite some time. This one surprised me a little bit that USC had not won a series against the Bruins since 2015, but that's what they did this weekend. They go into Jackie Robinson Stadium. They went on Friday night. UCLA comes back with a big win on Saturday, and then USC went off and won 6-3 in the finale to clinch the series. And this one was the one that the home team won, but Utah beat UW in their series. I don't know what UW is right now. I pretty consistently think Washington is good. They're a mystery right now. They weren't good last year. They hadn't played much of a – the schedule just hasn't lent itself to us learning a whole lot about the Huskies yet. But Utah is 11-3-1 now, and they won their first Pac-12 series since 2019, which is a little less impressive than it sounds when you consider that they didn't play in 2020. But still, they did not win a Pac-12 series last year, and they just won their first one. First year for Gary Henderson. The Utes are something. Looking forward to learning more about them. Joe, I imagine we want to talk most about Oregon and USC here. Where do you want to start?
I'm actually going to start with Utah.
Let's do it. I'm endlessly fascinated by this team. I shouldn't say endlessly. I am intrigued by this team.
Yeah, I actually watched a decent amount of like their first game on, I guess it was set. Like Saturday was such a weird day. You and I talked about this offline that so many of the games were pushed off of Saturday, especially here on the East Coast. So there wasn't a lot happening necessarily. And what was happening was, in the case of West Coast games, later in the afternoon. So the early afternoon felt a little bit, outside of Texas and South Carolina, felt a little bit empty. And so I tuned in for a little bit of Utah and Washington. I wrote about them in Three Strikes a couple weeks ago. I think they're going to pitch. you know, they've got Matthew Sox and Brandon Hostert, who are both, I think, pretty good, have a little bit of track record, are both kind of fringy prospecty guys. So there's that. Also, like, I think we forget, like, Gary Henderson is good at this. You know, he took over in that just bizarre situation Mississippi State was in several years ago.
That's Andy Cannizzaro being fired after the first, or resigning now, I don't remember precisely, after the first weekend of the season, if you forgot that one.
Yeah, indeed. If you need a refresher on that, I'm sure there is a blow-by-blow on some message board somewhere about the Andy Cannizzaro saga at Mississippi State early in that season. But, you know, he leads that team to Omaha and really kind of creates like this groundswell of support for him to get the full-time job, which I think we know now, and I think at the time even, like, knew that, well, that's probably not the best hire for Mississippi State. But he really put himself in the conversation with how well he managed that team. So, and then his career at Kentucky, not a place that has a lot of consistent SEC success, he had some success there. So I think he kind of gets underrated for his ability. And Utah is Utah. I did write in Three Strikes that it would just be a big step forward if Utah were to just make the Pac-12 tournament, because recall, the Pac-12 was having one of those this year. They're taking the top eight teams. And if that sounds like too modest of a goal to set for Utah, consider that if the Pac-12 had had a tournament the entire time Utah has been in the league, they would have qualified for it twice. And now we're going on like nine seasons or something. I don't have the number offhand, but they've been in the Pac-12 a while now. So that is, to me, not too modest of a goal to just get into the Pac-12 tournament, because it remains to be seen what Utah can be within the Pac-12. But I'm with you. Like, I think there's like a little something there. I don't think they're contending for the Pac-12 title. I'd love to be wrong on that, because that would be wild. But I do think it is a team that's kind of feisty. So anyway, moving on from that. For Stanford and Oregon, which is, I guess, where I'd like to start here. I guess I'm not too surprised that Oregon could do this, right? I mean, things have not gone perfectly for Oregon so far. You know, they lost a series to San Diego to begin the season. Adam Meyer, their prized transfer, has been on the shelf. There's some question about his availability moving forward. So there are some things happening here. However, it's still a very talented
They also,
team.
I should be said, completely like reset the rotation this weekend, both because Meyer was unavailable and like poor performances. Like they went into this weekend the very new look pitching staff.
Indeed. So like things have not gone perfectly, but it's still, it's a team we predicted to be in the postseason, you know, at the beginning of the year. Talented team, certainly have some nice pieces offensively, which we saw. To me, what's more interesting here is that it does draw into question some of what I think we thought we knew about Stanford. And I think, I don't want to completely take away what they've done on the mound so far this season, but I think I had bought in pretty hard on the idea of like, well, Stanford's figured it out on the mound, and there have been some big breakthroughs. It does appear that Drew Dowd is like a guy for them this year. You know, he pitched fairly well over the weekend. You know, Alex Williams has been pretty steady, but you know, you got a relatively short start from Quinn Matthews and got hit around a little bit, and the bullpen got beat up. You know, Braden Montgomery, who's been excellent for the most part this year, got hit around for really the first time this season in his outing. So I do think it draws into question a little bit of, did we get a little bit over our skis on thinking that Stanford had kind of figured out the formula? Now, it really just was the one game. Well, they did give up some, you know, they gave up a run late on the Tanner Smith home run, and, you know, they still gave up six runs on Sunday. So it's not like it was shutouts all around otherwise, but it really, we are just talking about the one game. So I don't want to press the panic button a little too quickly on this, but that is something to monitor moving forward is, you know, is the answer somewhere in the middle, right? The pitching staff is maybe better than they were last year, which I think is reasonable, but maybe isn't quite as much improved as we thought when they shut out Arkansas, for example, or pitched well against Arkansas. Now, especially now that we know that Arkansas offense is not necessarily clicking on all the cylinders we thought they were going to coming into the season.
Yeah, the how far we pushed out the boats when they gave up one run in 24 innings in Round Rock now feels very much like a, like, okay, like that was a bit of an overreaction. Quinn Matthews was outstanding that weekend. I believe he pitched against Arkansas. But he's also been got twice now. Fullerton got him on opening weekend, and Oregon got him in a big way this last weekend. So just they're lacking consistency there. they need to develop a bit more depth, it looks like. I wasn't at Round Rock, but I know the hitting conditions were pretty abysmal given how cold it was. It seems like Stanford maybe took advantage of that a little bit. I still like the upside of this team, but yeah, the questions that you had about the pitching staff coming into the season that seemed to be a bit resolved early on reared their ugly head again this last weekend. And, you know, Oregon is a good team. Oregon can hit. Mark Wasikowski, you know, has a good track record of having good hitting teams. But it's still not a great sign for Stanford that this happened at home against a team with as much mixed success this season as Oregon has had. Anytime it feels like Oregon's taking a step forward, it seems like they're taking a step back. And they were dealing with the Meyer news this week. It was a tough spot for Oregon to be in, and they responded outstandingly. And I think you have to feel good about the Ducks. Still waiting to hear how that pitching staff is going to come together moving forward. By the way, they didn't have the greatest weekend on the mound. They didn't have a bad weekend, but it wasn't a great weekend either. And they're going to need to pitch better moving forward. But I think they have to feel very good having gone on the road and won that series. But for Stanford now, it is a tough spot that they find themselves in, and, you know, following, you know, it just in terms of the pitching staff and the fact that they still need to build some more depth out.
Yeah, the other thing I'll say before we move on to USC and UCLA is, I think the other thing with Stanford is that, you know, maybe we're also seeing, you know, offensively, they have had a couple breakout stars, right? Like, so Brett Brera, Carter Graham, great starts to the season. But I do wonder if, like, we've seen with the Arizona offense, right, where I think we feel pretty good about it. This is once again an elite offense. And, oh, by the way, they haven't had Tony Bullard, who was thought to be one of the steadier guys in that lineup, was really hot last year in the postseason. They really haven't had him. And so I think we feel pretty good about this Arizona offense. We know what this offense is. It's, again, like a top flight offense. And, like, Stanford maybe isn't that. And, like, that's not – I'm not trying to cut that down necessarily. I still think it's a very, very good offense. But if we're drawing kind of – if we're picking nits between the top teams in the Pac-12, like, I do think that's an area where, yeah, I think Arizona's a little bit better there. And so as we start to evaluate these teams in the conference, I do think that's an area where – at this point, I'm giving the advantage to Arizona, which is not necessarily to say I've been underwhelmed by Stanford, but, you know, Arizona has just been, I think, a cut above when we talk about the best offenses in that league.
Well, here's the difference is that Tommy Troy and Brock Jones, who theoretically should be really the best two players on this Stanford offense, are, you know, Brock Jones has a 771 OPS and his on-base percentage is doing most of that work. He's on base of 438, which is great, like 15 walks on the season. He's walking more than once a game, but he only has 3 extra base hits. He doesn't have a home run. Like, that is not the player that I signed up for when I picked him to be the National Player of the Year. They need Brock Jones to get going. And Tommy Troy, who was very good as a freshman, went up to the Cape, played really well, has a lot of pedigree. He's hitting 244, 300, 311, and, like, he has 5 stolen bases, and that's great. But nothing else is working for Tommy Troy right now. So their stars aren't clicking. And I think that's obviously a big, you can look at that as a big positive for Stanford. Like, hey, if those two guys just get going, like, you know, then the offense will click in and it doesn't really matter whether the pitching staff is taking a big step forward or not, because, like, hey, this offense still has that potential. But on the flip side of it is, like, those guys aren't doing it yet, and we're now 4 weeks into the season.
Yeah, I mean, that's the thing, too, is, like, we're starting to get to the point of the season where you start to lose a little bit of the benefit of saying, like, well, it's still early. And there are, like, versions of that where they make some sense because a guy – like, I've talked to early in the season Monty Lee about Caden Grice, and he's hit some home runs, but he's still hitting, like, 250 or something. And he was like, yeah, he didn't play in the fall, so he's a little bit behind. And so there are instances like that. And we don't know all of those instances, right? But we are getting to the point of the season, though, where you do start to have to, like, cast a doubtful eye in some places. which is not the same thing as me. I would never doubt a Brock Jones. I'm a big fan as well, but just generally, we are at a point where you are no longer kind of able to look at it as just like assuming someone will come around and be something they haven't shown us they are so far.
Yeah, I mean, we are now like a quarter of the quarter of the way into the season, a little less than a quarter of the way, but we're about a quarter of the way into the season. And yeah, I mean, a 14 game sample size in the middle of the season isn't that, you know, okay, like guys go through skids and slumps and all the rest of it, but, and I'm not even here to say Brock Jones is slumping. Again, the dude is clearly getting pitched around, but like you do at some point have to be the difference maker. And, you know, that's what Stanford's waiting for right now. What they're hoping for still. And I'm sure they'll get eventually, but that is something that needs to change. In addition to, again, a little more consistency from the pitching staff. So UCLA came in into the week. We were feeling really good about them and the Baby Bruins after what they did in the Shriners College Classic, particularly what they did to close it out, beating Texas. And they got hit pretty hard by USC. And I don't mean like the pitching staff got batted around. I just mean that USC came in and this is a rivalry that John Savage has dominated, just absolutely dominated throughout his career. And USC said not this year. And they did it in an intriguing way, Joe. They got, USC did, to UCLA starting pitching on Friday and Sunday. They got to Jake Brooks and they got to Kelly Austin. And I don't know that that's a repeat. Like, I don't think that we just saw a formula for how you beat UCLA this year, because I don't know how often that's going to happen. But it happened for USC. And USC was a team that came into the weekend. They were like 9-2, but it was an empty 9-2. They hadn't played a team with a winning record since opening weekend. And the team that they played was Santa Clara, which is a perfectly solid West Coast Conference team, but it's not like they had, you know, I don't know how good Santa Clara is. You know, it's not like they had gone out and beaten some regional team from a year ago. It was a nice win, but a nice series win, but we didn't know a whole lot about USC. They sure seemed to prove something this weekend.
Yeah, for sure. I mean, I think it showed that USC is ready to compete in series like this against teams like UCLA, which is not, in recent history for USC, has not necessarily been a given. I don't know. I feel less confident in this series, though, understanding what we're necessarily looking at, right? Because when you really break it down, it is true they got to Jake Brooks and got to Kelly Austin. They got to them in one inning each. And that's good. Like, I'm not, like, big innings are how you win games. Like, so
it also, like, they got to them early. Like, it's the first inning in one game and the second inning in another game. Right. And then those guys settled down. And that's, you see that with starters.
For sure. Yeah. So, I mean, that can cut both ways, right? Like, the positive spin of that is like, big innings is how you win games. And they really rode those big innings to victories. And the other side of it is like, well, it wasn't necessarily sustained success for the offense throughout the weekend. It was just these like short outbursts offensively. So,
and it should be said that they got worked on Saturday.
For sure. Yeah. And by the way, like, this is like just a little detail that like is really kind of tangential, but like one thing UCLA does really well, I feel like, is like, I noticed in Jake Brooks's start, like, he gave up those four runs in the second inning. He pitched seven innings. Like, UCLA, I think, does a really good job, and we shouldn't be surprised because they do a good job with pitchers, of understanding, okay, this guy's getting hit, but he's still our best guy right now. When I think a lot of other teams are quicker, and like, this is valid too, like those guys know better than I do, but a lot of teams are quick to just be like, nah, not his day, moving on. I think UCLA has a really good feeling for their pitchers and understanding like that, yes, he's given up runs, but he is still our best option right this minute. And so I think that showed in that situation, but that's, again, just a tangential thought I had. But what I do like from UCLA, I mean, first of all, they do have some electric position player talents, like DeAndre Smith and Tyrese Turner are like a really underrated middle infield duo, I feel like. You know, those are two guys who really haven't had a lot of a chance to shine, and I think that's been pandemic and Pac-12 related, if I can put it that way. I mean, 2020 season being what it was, then also the fact that those guys played in a, first of all, for a Pac-12 team that wasn't all that relevant last year, and also the Pac-12 being a league that kind of is a little more hidden unless you really make a deep postseason run. So those guys.
Talk about the Pac-12 network.
Yeah, let's get back into this. I am a consumer now. I'm actually interacting with the product now, and I'm pretty satisfied. I just like that. I guess it's less that I have actual like takes on the product and more that I'm just glad I have it now. And it was nice to be able to watch USC and UCLA like in living color.
And tangentially quickly, and I promise not to turn this into me on the Pac-12 network again, but like this series was on Pac-12 network all weekend, and that means I didn't get to see it. Joe has Pac-12 network. I don't. I get Longhorn network. He doesn't. But they scheduled the third game, like, and basically is counter programming to the selection show. Every other, I assume that the ACC and the SEC network were showing some sort of, related to the basketball selection shows. The Pac-12 was like, nah, we'll just put this baseball game on. It's fine.
Yeah, that was a, yeah.
It was a decision.
The funny thing about it is too, is on like a normal Sunday, that would have been kind of like, I guess it wouldn't have mattered for you because you couldn't have seen it, but like just generally, having a game on at that time, that was like 6 Eastern, on a Sunday would be kind of nice because by then most everything is usually wrapped up. But like on this particular Sunday, we did not need it because there was so much going on. Like at even as late as like 8 o'clock, there were still several top 25 games going on and a bunch of other stuff outside of that. But yeah, it was kind of an interesting choice there, to be sure. I mean, there is also the gripe with the Pac-12 where, like, I downloaded the app on my TV for Pac-12 Now, and basically all it wants you to do is open the Pac-12 Now app on your phone, pull up a stream, and then cast it to your TV. Now, that could be because I have an older smart TV. I do. The thing's like 4 or 5 years old now. But I was like, that's less than ideal. I kind of thought I could just pull the streams up from the app on the TV, but I guess not. Regardless, I do have Pac-12 Network now. And update, I also do have Longhorn Network. I just didn't know. Sling TV coming through, but I just haven't watched it much because, you know, when Texas has been at home, I've been other places or I've been seeing Texas live. So haven't had a chance to interface with that very much. It's been a while since I've had LHN, but I do have that one as well. So where were we?
USC, intriguing team. DeAndre Smith not getting the love that they got, or if he maybe should have gotten a year ago.
Yeah, he and Tyrese Turner, just kind of a fun middle infield duo. I think where the most positive thing is, though, and who knows how much to read into it against a young UCLA lineup that, I wrote about it in Houston, like showed signs of progress, but also scored one run on a solo home run, by the way, against Baylor to open that weekend. So like not exactly an offense that's you know, is proofed against, you know, having stinkers.
Yeah, they're not clicked in. Like they scored 11 runs on Saturday, I guess, but we're pretty well shut down the other two games. It's very, very up and down, and with so many young players, not to be unexpected.
Indeed. But that being said, you know, USC is without Isaac Escueda right now, although I did hear on the broadcast on Friday, Jason Gill, USC's coach, say that they expect him back in about 3 weeks, he said. So it does sound like he's coming back. So that is good news there. But without him, they pitched pretty well. Jaden Agassi was just okay. But I liked what I saw from Tyler Stromsborg. Charlie Hurley had a really good start. So it does feel like they do have some arms that are going to keep them in games. We have them ranked right now, understandably so. There were just also some slots to fill in the top 25, let's be frank. I still think I like long-term UCLA this season. The talent for UCLA is just so good. I still think come May, I'm going to like UCLA more than I do USC. But for right now, you know, I think USC's got a team that's just a little further along in what it's going to be. And that's what we saw over the weekend.
Yeah, USC is number 25. That's the first time USC has been ranked since the preseason of 2016. There was a lot of debate into what we were going to do with UCLA and USC. And ultimately, we decided that, USC won this series in Westwood. We need to have them and not UCLA if we're going to have any of them. And ultimately we landed on including USC at number 25. Quick trivia time, Joe. USC fell out of the top 25 there pretty quick in 2016. Do you remember why?
Ooh, Do they lose a series to Santa Clara?
It was North Dakota. What turned out to be North Dakota's final season. They cut the program later that year, but North Dakota went out to USC and won a series on opening weekend.
I do remember that. I'm glad you brought that up. I do. I absolutely 100% do remember that, because then I think North Dakota went and played, I think, Alabama pretty well, like, that following weekend. And it was like, oh, okay, this North Dakota team. They had a pitcher whose name was Zach Muckenhern.
I'm glad you remember the first name, because all I got was Muckenhern. Like, that definitely has stuck with me. But
Zach Muckenhern. I feel like they also had a guy or two that transferred to, like, bigger places. Didn't LSU have a guy for a while? No, I'm thinking of Akron.
Yeah, that was Akron. Program. What North Dakota did have was, if they had kept the program one more year, they had Matt Wallner committed and Jake Adams.
Oh, that's right. I forgot about that. Can you imagine that offense? Like, Matt Wallner and Jake Adams, like, facing, like, low major pitching. Like, my goodness. Like, they might have had 35 home runs apiece.
Cake Adams, as he came to be known, hit what? Like, I think he hit 20 home runs one year in the Big Ten. Like, he would have absolutely destroyed, like, whack pitching.
Yeah.
Like that, whack, that's kind of a Summit League, whatever league that was.
Yeah, I think, like, that's the thing, is that, like, who knows? But the real shame, I mean, it's obviously a shame that any program gets cut, but, like, that one was actually probably on the precipice of something. Like, given how well they played, winning a series against USC, playing other teams well, and then what they had.
Muckenhern was like a top 10 to 15 round draft that year. Like, yeah, it was, things were happening there.
Yeah. Like, they were clearly actually getting things done, and yeah, had the rug pulled, which unfortunately we've become all too accustomed to.
Absolutely. All right, so those were a lot of the top headlines. Otherwise, Gonzaga went to play Long Beach State, and the Dirtbags won the series. That was a really entertaining series. The finale was a 1-0 game that Long Beach State walked off with. It was 0-0 for the longest time there. The Zags still feel good about where they are. Like, yeah, they lost a series, but they lost a tough series on the road, like, whatever. If you look at what they've accumulated to this point, and the fact that they, again, have yet to play a home game and aren't scheduled to play one anytime soon, like, they're still out there compiling big, significant wins. For the Dirtbags, this was kind of a get right series. They got a really big offensive day on Saturday, showed that they can pitch with a really good team that is Gonzaga. They did it without Luis Ramirez this weekend. He's slated to return next week against Hawaii. We'll certainly keep an eye on that, but they're back to 500 now, which is significant, and it feels like they've arrested the slide that they were on when they lost six in a row there after winning the first two at Mississippi State. Dallas Baptist beat Southern Miss. They swept Southern Miss, I should say, at home. And that's another team that it feels like has arrested its early season slide. They lost three of their first four, but really have righted the ship and are now 9-6. Tulane kind of did the opposite. They crashed pretty hard this week after last week beating Mississippi State. They were swept at home by Evansville, and that's going to leave a mark on the RPI all season long unless Evansville really turns things around. Joe, anything else? All right, Liberty split with Campbell. I should mention that. Anything else stand out for you across the country?
Did you mention, and pardon me, because I was doing a number of things in the background. Okay, first of all, I was looking to see how far away, like, Dado Field is from Jackie Robinson Stadium at UCLA, just because there was always the joke of, like, that's a technically road game for USC, and it probably felt like a road game because it might have taken them 2.5 hours to drive there. Probably did not take them that long. Currently, though, I mean, that's 11 miles away, and currently in LA traffic, which doesn't look too bad right now because it's, you know, basically noon on a Monday on the East Coast, so 9 a.m. on the West Coast.
That's the end of rush hour, though. Like,
yeah, I mean, it said it was going to take 32 minutes to make it 11 miles, which doesn't, that's not too bad, actually. I definitely, when I was in LA, I definitely had stretches that were much worse than that. So anyway, so I was trying to prepare that joke. It kind of fell through. And then I was, you know, catching up on, like, Long Beach State, like, in terms of what I was going to say about Long Beach State, I guess, is that they, like right now it's hard to know what to make of them, and they're just 7-7 overall. And you know, the Sacramento State deal was weird. But I think what we can say though is they've done enough work in the non-conference now that if they are as good as we think they that we think they could be, like, I think it's still a team that's in position to be an at-large club if they need it.
I agree with that, because Mississippi State, we don't know exactly what they are, but even bad SEC teams have good RPIs, and Mississippi right. State, we don't think, is a bad SEC team, so they should have a great RPI. And Gonzaga is going to have a good RPI just the way that they've scheduled and played so far. So you do have 4 wins against those 2 teams, and 2 of those are road wins, and the Big West isn't going to be awful to your RPI. Like, and actually right now, if you look at it, Big West has some good RPI teams. I've been very down privately on the Big West just because, you know, Long Beach State went through that skid, and Irvine missed an opportunity. Santa Barbara missed an opportunity here or there. Cal Poly hasn't been, you know, anything special despite having some superstars. And, but if you look at it, some of those teams are compiling decent RPIs. And so, yeah, if Long Beach State is the team that they should be, that, that they were thought to be in the preseason, I think that they can, you know, pretty comfortably still be an at-large team.
Yeah. I mean, you can't go 500 in the Big West, but as long as they do what we think they can do in the Big West, that's a team that still set itself up to be a postseason team. What I was going to ask you though, is if you talked about Purdue.
I did not. We have briefly mentioned Purdue back when I mentioned that Clemson and Virginia lost, and now Purdue is the lone remaining undefeated team in the country at 14-0.
Yeah, it's, you know, undefeated is undefeated. The schedule, it should be said, has not been good. They do have one against
Less
Charlotte.
Less than good. It has been bad.
Yeah, it has not been very good. And so
one of those 14 games has been played against a team with a winning record. It is Charlotte, like, that's a nice thing, but one of 14 games against a team with a winning record.
Indeed. You know, it has mostly been on the road, like, or I guess neutral sites. Like, okay. So that's good. So I think we can comfortably say, well, we can say for sure, the last undefeated team in college baseball, Division I college baseball anyway. I think we could also pretty confidently say Purdue is better. Previous Purdue teams probably would have found a way to lose some of these games along the way. So I think Purdue is better. I like Jackson Smeltz, the front of the rotation, left-hander, good stuff. Numbers are really, really good so far. I think he's a real guy. They've got some good offensive pieces. So I think this team is better. How much better, and if they are a potential postseason team out of the Big Ten, I think is very much still an open question, but they deserve kudos for being where they are. We talked about them in the top 25. Just, I think we're going to need to see them play someone that we're a little more confident in being a good team before we jump in on them.
Yeah, it's a challenging thing to know. Like, these the last undefeated team, assuming it's not a team that you expected to be good coming into the year or that you were ranking in the top 25 to begin with, it's a challenge. Every single year, it's a challenge because the zero, you want it to mean something. Like, your brain is conditioned for it to mean something. But again, Purdue has played one of the worst schedule. If you look at strength of schedule right now, it is bottom 40, bottom 30 maybe in the country. And I don't know how much confidence I have in that metric yet, but everything says it's a bad schedule. You can look at it and understand it's a bad schedule. And like, I'm not here to really complain about Purdue playing the schedule at all. They went 16-26 last year. Like, they're trying to build some momentum here. Like, I get it. But okay, they're 14-0, and that much respect to that. You know who's 12-1 right now is Southeast Missouri State, and that one is a loss at DBU in a series that they won. So the rest of SEMO's schedule, not great either, but like, they went out and won a series on the road at DBU, which is significantly better than anything Purdue has done. SEMO has one loss. Like, why is zero so much bigger than the one there? And, you know, I did that with SEMO. That's off the top of my head. Like, we jokingly looked at SEMO last night because I was doing some DBU research and, you know, noticed that, hey, SEMO still hasn't lost since they lost in that finale against DBU. You know, SEMO could be undefeated right now, and then we'd be talking about them too. And you know, they're not. I get it, all the rest of that, but I guess the point here is that yes, Purdue is undefeated. Yes, we talked about them for the top 25. They're not ranked, though, because there are still very good one-loss teams out there that are not really even in the conversation at all. And so while winning every single one of your games is certainly better than winning all but one, the zero at this point, just between the schedule that they've played and the fact that there are really good like one-loss teams out there, it just didn't feel like it was Purdue's time.
Agreed. And, you know, they take a nice little step up. It's not a huge leap, but a nice step up this weekend, playing four games, like a four game split home and home with Illinois State, two games in Normal Thursday, Friday, two games in West Lafayette, Saturday, Sunday. And
Illinois let's State not overlook Dayton in the midweek. Dayton off to a nice start as well.
Yeah, for sure. So a five game week this week that is going to push them in a way they haven't been pushed so far. And so, you know, Purdue could go 4-1 or 3-2 this week, and I might be more impressed with that than I have anything so far this season, as a way to show that the Purdue is a little bit better. Unique weekend this weekend, but the connection there, Steve Holm and Wally Crancer, who are on staff at Illinois State, were at Purdue under Mark Wasikowski, with those best of those Purdue teams under Waz. So there is a connection there, which is probably part of the reason they're doing this type of setup.
Related to Purdue, Purdue is now, like I mentioned, they won 16 games last year. They could this week match their win total from last season. This is definitely under the radar. I can't believe Joe isn't bringing that. I'm the one bringing this up, and that Joe isn't. Not that I'm not saying, Joe, this should have been on your radar. It just, this is a very Joe kind of note here. Jacksonville swept FIU this weekend, and JU, you might remember, they won the ASUN tournament last year. They got into the field with like 16 wins. They were like 16-34 or something last year going into the NCAA tournament. And they get in
because they're in the ASUN.
Yeah, they went through this crazy, crazy ASUN tournament run. JU's totally flipped the script on that. They had 11 wins going into the ASUN tournament last year. They've completely flipped the script on that in from 2021. They're now 11-5 this year. They swept FIU this weekend. They won in 20 innings on Sunday to finish the sweep. They also have a win against Florida State. They won a series against Troy. They only lost 1-0 to Florida on Tuesday. I would need to dig into JU more, but the way they're playing right now, especially the way they're pitching, I think they can challenge in the ASUN. Like, Liberty is great, and what we've seen from Liberty is really impressive. But JU might be a decent foil to the Flames there. And at minimum, like, they are what the turnaround that they're showing is amazing. They've already won as many regular season games as they did a year ago.
Yeah, they were a weird, when I previewed the ASUN, they were a weird team for me because what do you do with a team that, you know, going into last year was pretty veteran? And so I think I predicted them, you know, certainly top half of the ASUN, and then they were not good and really struggled in ASUN play, and they get hot and go to a regional. Okay, so that should be a positive indicator for what they could be in 2022. But oh, by the way, they were a veteran team last year, so they lost most of their contributors. So it was like a new team this year. You know, offensively, they were, I think the main returner they had was Christian Coipel, who is hitting 175 right now. Like, he has four home runs, so I guess there's that. But like, it was an offense last year that I think going into this year, they'd lost everyone offensively who hit more than one home run last year or something like that. And they weren't, you know, a power oriented team, so that wasn't part of their game, but it just goes to show that how much they were rebuilding. So I had no idea what to do with this team coming into the season. I think I predicted them pretty low in the ASUN, frankly. But here they are. I think you're right. I mean, I think this is a team that has clearly taken a step forward, and we'll have to see. I mean, JU kind of does this. They probably get underrated a little bit for how consistent they are in the ASUN. And so it kind of stands to reason, if nothing else, that even if you just throw away the getting hot at the right time in the ASUN tournament, even if you kind of set that aside, like coming off of a season when they struggled as much as they did last year, it does stand to reason they would be better this year, because this is not a program that typically has long extended stretches of being down.
All right, that's going to do it for us wrapping up week four here on the Baseball America College podcast. A lot of action around the country. It was a fun weekend. It was a very weather affected weekend, but it wound up being a fun weekend nonetheless. Hopefully we get some better weather this week, some really intriguing midweek matchups on tap, and then a great slate of games coming up this weekend. More conferences are getting into conference play this weekend, most notably, of course, the SEC. But there's a soft Big 12 opening with one series. Conference USA is getting into conference play. There's a lot more going on this weekend. So another fun week of college baseball on tap. We'll have it all covered for you over at baseballamerica.com. You can follow us on Twitter. I'm at Ted Cahill. Joe is at Joe Healy, BA. And we will be back here on Thursday with another edition of the Baseball America College Podcast, previewing week five and talking about whatever comes up here in the midweek here in week four. And I now realize there was a coaching change over the weekend. San Francisco fired Neo Giuntano after allegations of misconduct. New allegations of misconduct came to light in a lawsuit that was filed last week. He had previously been investigated and publicly reprimanded in the fall. Reprimand happened in January, but new allegations in the lawsuit combined with some other stuff led to the firing. I guess we'll get into that on Thursday, Joe, because we're not going to do it now. Hopefully we'll have a little bit more information then. So anyway, make sure you subscribe to the Baseball America College Podcast on your favorite podcasting app, Stitcher, Spotify, Apple Podcasts. Wherever you find your podcasts, you can find us. Hit that follow button and we'll pop back into your phone on Thursday as we go twice a week during the college season. Thank you all for listening. For Joe, I'm Teddy. We'll talk to you next time.